This is the Cedar Ethics Podcast number 22 for August 2010.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cedar Ethics Podcast, a show about bioethics and the defense of human life. From the Center for Bioethics on the campus of Cedarville University in Cedarville, Ohio, my name is Dennis Sullivan, your host, with a perspective informed by scripture, philosophy, and common sense. My guest today is Dr. Jeff Lewis, Assistant Dean of the School of Pharmacy at Cedarville University and Associate Professor of Pharmacy Practice. Dr. Lewis, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dr. Sullivan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Our topic today is emergency contraception. And I've asked Dr. Lewis to join us because of all the controversy and confusion about this subject, which I hope you can help me, Dr. Lewis, to clarify for our listeners. First of all, let's begin by defining some terms, and let's start with the simplest definition. What is a contraceptive?
Well, certainly. Contraception itself, I think, is confusing to the general population, even, by the very nature of the terms that we use. We're used to using the term contraception for the prevention of pregnancy, and individuals know that term by the use of daily contraceptive pills or oral contraceptives, birth control pills, often called. But even those nomenclatures tend to introduce confusion, I believe, into the public's mind. A contraceptive, the word itself, means contra or against conception, against the joining of a sperm and an egg, fertilization, if you will, where birth control, another term that we often apply, may lend itself to any number of types of actions in the process of conceiving and birthing a baby. So a birth control pill could be anything that gets in the way of any step in the process, from conception to the implantation of that fertilized egg into the woman's uterus to the actual birth process itself. But here for this broadcast, we typically will use contraception and birth control as synonymous terms.
Okay. So in other words, you're making the broader point that contraception is really a practice that involves a number of kinds of things that could include barrier methods and other kinds of interventions.
Absolutely.
But when you talk about a contraceptive as an oral agent, we're usually talking about the pill, which typically does what? What does the pill do in its actions? We're talking about the common birth control pill that women may often take in order to prevent pregnancy.
The pill that we have come to note as is a combination, at least typically a combination, of two different hormones. A progestin, as we would call it, and an estrogen, essentially what we often think of as a male and a female hormone, but mostly the estrogen. Those two hormones are part of the reproduction cycle, and what happens during the reproductive cycle is those two hormones cause the reproductive system to recognize the development of an egg, to at times produce an environment for that fertilized egg to implant in the uterus, and also tell the body that we don't need to ovulate, we don't need to release an egg into the system. And so what happens with these oral hormonal contraceptives is we essentially add additional hormones into the female system, telling the body that we've already ovulated. It's tricking the body into believing ovulation is taking place.
So are you saying then that I commonly hear women say that the pill fools the body into thinking it's pregnant? Is that an accurate statement, or would you clarify it further?
Well, I think that it may more so fool the body into thinking it's already made itself ready to be pregnant. Not that it's pregnant per se, but that it's already taken the action to become pregnant by releasing an egg ready to be fertilized.
Okay, good. So in common practice, we know that oral contraceptives have been used for many years. Mm-hmm. There's a We're not going to get into the side effects of those today, but they're commonly used, commonly held to be safe, and not too much ethical controversy about contraceptives in general.
I think that's true.
In bioethics, and in the general conversations in the culture wars between the various parts of our society, be it the pro-life movement versus liberal feminism and other entities within our society, people worry about some drugs being an abortifacient. What does that mean, and what is the ethical concern here?
Well, the first part of that very complex term, abortifacient, has the portion that says abort. And we often think about that in the context of aborting a fetus. The abortion controversy runs deep and wide, a very emotional topic. When we talk about abortifacients in medicine and in pharmacy as part of that, we're looking at medicines that have the potential to cause abortion, to cause the expulsion of a viable fetus, and which brings in great controversy from a moral and ethical perspective. Because depending on your worldview, on your faith structure, there are very differing points of view that would help one determine where and when in the process of development that living being becomes something that we need to protect.
Okay. Very good. Well, there is a fairly common belief that I have encountered as a bioethicist on the campus of Cedarville University that ordinary birth control pills can sometimes act by preventing implantation, and therefore they are abortifacient and therefore morally wrong, at least on the pro-life understanding of things. What's your take on that?
My personal perspective after reviewing the data with regarding that particular topic is that ordinary birth control pills, as we've known them for many years, data associated with that type of medicine years ago had some indication that there may be limited effects on the uterine lining. And that limited data was extrapolated to such a point where people came to believe that therefore it must have abortifacient potential. I think that the years and data have borne out the fact that that's just simply not the case, that the sole effect of hormonal contraception in terms of the pill as we've come to know it is strictly a contraceptive, preventing conception, and really doesn't have any effects on implantation of the embryo in the uterus.
Okay, good. Now we're going to head in the direction of our main topic today, which okay. is this newer ethical dimension that's caused a lot of discussion in college campuses, in pharmacies across the country, mm-hmm. in doctors' offices, and in the highest realms of our federal courts and in our executive branch of government. And that is the area of emergency contraception. So mm-hmm. let's discuss that matter. What is emergency contraception? How does it differ from normal, the daily pill? And what is its typical role in our society?
Sure. Well, let's first just define emergency contraception as we've come to call it. Essentially, emergency contraception is the last chance that a woman may have to prevent an otherwise unwanted pregnancy. That may be necessary in the face of any number of events. Contraceptive failure, barrier contraceptive breakage, for condom breakage as an example of that, forgetting to take the pill on one or more days, or any other number of potential misuse or failure to use contraceptive methods. The idea of emergency contraception means that after an act of coitus or an act of sexual intimacy, there is still an opportunity to prevent pregnancy. And in our case, and most importantly, to prevent the fertilization of the egg by a sperm cell. So emergency contraception is really that last chance effort that is available approximately up to 3 days after sexual intimacy to effect that type of a change.
Okay, so would I be correct in assuming that the primary normal mechanism of emergency contraception, and we'll get into some of the individual agents in a moment, the primary goal of emergency contraception is to prevent ovulation or release of an egg from the ovary in the first place. Is that my proper understanding?
That would be not only the primary objective, but as we understand it now, the primary mechanism of the available emergency contraceptives. For several years, we've used traditional hormonal contraceptives, those pills, in different doses than we use on day-to-day basis for prevention, if you will, for prophylactic contraception, as an emergency contraceptive whose sole impact appears to be prevention of ovulation, doing the same thing in an emergency basis that the daily pill did on an ongoing basis.
I see. Well, of course, then we come to the most commonly dispensed agent that's available in our culture, and that's the drug commonly known as Plan B, which is a progestin called levonorgestrel. And we've had a lot of discussion that has led to an FDA ruling allowing Plan B or levonorgestrel to be available without a prescription over the counter, as it were, at any pharmacy that is willing to dispense it in the United States. And this has led to a lot of controversy. What is the controversy about in terms of this particular agent? Why might there be an ethical concern if, as you say, Plan B or levonorgestrel has merely the effect of blocking ovulation? Is there another concern? Why are people very upset about this in our pro-life movement, certainly? What's going on there?
I think in the evolution of any particular drug's lifetime, if you will, there's a gaining of information and understanding about how a drug might work. Levonorgestrel is essentially an analog or a cousin of the progestin drug that we've typically been using in the hormonal contraceptives. There was a thought, according to some data that was published, some studies that were conducted 10 to 15 years previous to today, that there must be some additional mechanisms of action associated with levonorgestrel or Plan B, because the data didn't seem to bear out the fact that what they were seeing could only be attributed to prevention of ovulation. And so the researchers at that time surmised that something else might be happening. And the something else that they surmised was that potentially Plan B is interfering with the ability of a fertilized egg to implant successfully into the uterine lining so that it could further develop to maturity. It turns out that over the last 10 years, a lot more studies have been conducted that have helped us to understand that some of the assumptions that were made in the earlier trials were simply not true. More definitive data has shown us that that Plan B really does act solely by preventing ovulation or possibly by the prevention of conception by slowing down the ability of a sperm cell to reach that egg. I think that's still a viable option, but it's very clear to me that it does not interfere with implantation of a fertilized egg. Now, the controversy has grown, and it's very difficult to unwind 10 to 15 years of data. It's a very passionate topic.
I see.
But the data today seems to bear itself out in such a way that what we thought might be the case, it was never proven to be or to hold abortifacient potential, but only surmised to be. I believe that that's been laid to rest, and we're hoping that the general medical community will be able to more effectively communicate that to patients now.
Well, that's a strong claim in face of the very strong idea out there in the pro-life community, especially among Roman Catholic pro-life spokespersons. I know many with whom that I have spoken that are convinced that Plan B is abortive. And this has been the occasion of pharmacists in the United States, sometimes even losing their jobs because they're unwilling to dispense this agent, which they believe to be abortive. And of course, we should perhaps be sympathetic to those pharmacists who are willing to take a stand for their convictions.
Well, absolutely.
Certainly those of us who are pro-life, I know you and I are passionately committed mm-hmm. to the sanctity of human life from conception. Mm-hmm. And so would you agree with me that if we did prove that Plan B or any other agent actually blocked the implantation of an embryo, would this raise grave ethical concerns with you as it does with me?
Absolutely. Yeah, the picture changes dramatically at that point, whereas the abortive patient potential being proven would place Plan B in a completely different camp, if you will, than
okay.
where it rests today in my mind.
Hi, this is Jessica Zaring with the Center for Bioethics at Cedarville University. Plan now to join us for the 2010 Healthcare Ethics Conference on September 15th through 17th. Partnering with Johnny & Friends International, our theme is Protecting the Vulnerable in the 21st Century. We have gathered an array of leading experts providing Christian perspectives on key issues facing the church, our healthcare system, and the medical profession. The three-day conference will feature plenary sessions by Dr. Kathy McReynolds, a scholar with Johnny & Friends, and nationally recognized bioethicists Dr. Christopher Hook and Dr. Nigel Cameron. In addition, breakout sessions will include leaders and scholars in two tracks, pastoral ministry and healthcare. All sessions, meals, printed materials, and an evening banquet are included in the low registration price. For more information, call 937-766-4444 or go to cedarville.edu/bioethics2010.
Well, as though that were not enough controversy, we now have a new agent on the market, or at least approved by the FDA just last week, as to the date of recording of this podcast on August 18th, 2010. And that is a drug that goes by the brand name of ELLA, small letter, E-L-L-A. Uloprostol is the chemical name, uloprostol acetate. And this raises another set of ethical questions. And so talk to us a little bit about some of the concerns that perhaps we might want to raise about this newest agent about which there's been a lot less study.
Absolutely. Uloprostol acetate, or ELLA, has actually been available in Europe for about a year now, so not a great length of time. Usually the United States will begin marketing or approving for market drugs after they've been used in Europe for significantly longer periods than this. But uloprostol is a very different agent than Plan B or levonorgestrel. You know, very interestingly, levonorgestrel as a progestin has a value in the reproductive cycle that actually augments the development of the uterine lining, which is one of the reasons that it didn't make sense to me, and to many others for that matter, that it would have some abortive patient potential by causing some sort of uterine disruption, implantation disruption, because its whole purpose, or at least one of its primary purposes, was to help that process, not hinder it. In contrast, uloprostol is what we would call an anti-progestin product. It is a product that blocks the utility of progestin. In fact, uloprostol is a cousin of a product that's been known in this country for several years, a product we call mifepristone, or what the general public may know more commonly as RU486, a product that is indeed used for, because of that mechanism of action, the medication abortion that is very clearly different than emergency contraception or any sort of contraception for that matter. It's sometimes used in very low doses, this mifepristone, as an emergency contraceptive, a much different dose than we use for abortion. And the mechanism of action of that is unproven, but would seem to, at least at times, have the potential to be an abortive agent even in those low doses. This new agent, ELLA, or uloprostol acetate, is a cousin to mifepristone. And so it's been marketed in the United States as an emergency contraceptive. But unlike levonorgestrel, that at one time had the idea associated with it, it might be abortifacient, there was really no evidence to support that per se. Ulipristal is in a completely different camp. Ulipristal has significant evidence because of its cousin mifepristone that it has abortifacient potential, the dose at which we're not really sure of. And so the marketing of this particular agent in the United States right now causes us significant concern because of that specific potential.
Okay, that's a very good point. And another thing that I have noticed about this new drug is that ELA is recommended as a 5-day emergency contraceptive. Now, mm-hmm. does that bear significance? And I would remind our listeners that from the time of fertilization up in the fallopian tubes to implantation is a period of time that takes between 6.5 to 7 days, depending on how fast transport of the developing embryo can take place. So with fertilization, on the view that you and I hold both metaphysically and scientifically, we have a developing embryo, a developing human being, that is on its way to implantation in the uterus. And we have an agent that is promising that women will not become pregnant, and they can take this after unprotected intercourse for up to 5 days after that activity. Mm-hmm. What ethical mm-hmm. significance would you draw from that?
Well, there's several issues to be aware of when we talk about emergency contraception. The first is any emergency contraceptive product, as we have known them heretofore, has less efficacy. It's less likely to be effective as each hour and day passes after that sexual intimacy. So if you wait 1 day with Plan B versus 3 days to take Plan B after sexual intimacy, the effectiveness drops off significantly. When they have studied the use of ELA, similar types of patterns exist. The longer you wait, the less effective this medicine happens to be. However, because of the mechanism of action of ELA, at least it's the drug itself as we know it compared to mifepristone or RU486, and what you were referring to earlier in terms of the timing of the development or the conception and the implantation, there's a significant chance that some of the effectiveness that we're seeing out at 5 and 6 days of use of a product like ELA may actually be specifically due to interruption of implantation as opposed to interruption of conception itself or any other process, interruption of ovulation is prior to that. We know that Plan B is not effective after pregnancy is established. Once a fertilized egg is implanted into the uterus, it has no effect at all, which is another one of the reasons we have gained great comfort in the idea that it is really simply an anti-ovulatory drug or possibly something other with migration of sperm or something, but certainly not an anti-implantation drug. However, with ELA, ulipristal, that line is being blurred dramatically because of the opportunity to use this product 5 days out, and clearly does have effectiveness in terms of preventing pregnancy. Now, that in this case may not prevent the initiation of pregnancy, it may prevent the continuation of pregnancy.
And then we would have indeed crossed the line into an abortifacient drug. There's a phrase that has been used by some of my pro-life colleagues, the hostile endometrium. Mm-hmm. And this was the idea first espoused by Dr. Walter Larimore, mm-hmm. Who is a gifted physician who has studied these matters, who has in the past taken a position that I disagree with about commonly prescribed daily contraceptives, but for whom I have great respect. And he began to raise some of these questions about a hostile endometrium. Mm-hmm. And I've been loath to use that term. Perhaps you're saying, as I understand what you're sharing, that ELA, we may have finally achieved an agent that creates a hostile environment for implantation, or at least we should have studied this much more before granting this FDA approval.
I think that that's the real key here. We have known for quite some time that there might be subtle changes in the endometrium associated with the use of hormonal contraceptives. However, it has become fairly clear that it has absolutely nothing to do with the mechanism of action of those particular products. there has been some good data published regarding the use of Plan B, identifying whether or not the use of levonorgestrel Plan B has any significant effect on the endometrial lining. And it doesn't seem to have any effect at all. We know that RU486 or mifepristone does indeed create a hostile endometrium.
Yes.
This cousin product, ulipristal acetate or ELA, seems to potentially have that same type of mechanism of action. The problem is that has never been fully studied. One of the things that the FDA put into the official labeling of the information that's handed out to patients is that this medication may act by some mechanism other than prevention of ovulation. In fact, they put into the labeling, in the same way they did Plan B, that it may act by the prevention of implantation mm-hmm. of the fertilized egg. And so what we have now is a similar situation that to some degree that we had with levonorgestrel, a potential to have an additional effect. The contrast is with levonorgestrel, we had very limited evidence at the beginning and no evidence now that that was going to be the case. With ulipristal acetate, we have significant evidence based on other similar drugs that this is or might be the case even at low doses, which is what we're using in a relative sense with ulipristal, relatively low dose. We have that great potential, and yet it has not been fully elucidated in the official labeling, in the approval process. And that's the great concern for us as those who hold to that pro-life sanctity of human life from conception perspective, is that we indeed have a drug on the market today that may have abortifacient potential that has not been borne out completely, and yet is available to the general public by prescription only, unlike levonorgestrel, which does have an over-the-counter status up down to 17 years of age. But now this product may be being used by patients unaware of the real potential that it holds, and the ability for healthcare professionals, the lay press, and any other group who may weigh in on the matter to communicate that effectively to an individual, a woman who is in an emergency situation and is not thinking clearly necessarily of what she is in getting herself into, may not see the harm because the understanding and the communication is ineffective.
Well, in other words, you're saying that this marketing of this agent might in fact be misleading and might be contrary to some of the ethical views of women patients out there.
Absolutely.
And may have that detrimental effect on their free, autonomous choice to make decisions about their care.
What's important for us to understand is that the pharmaceutical company that would manufacture, market, or distribute, and there are actually multiple companies involved in the process of getting this product, ELA, to the end user, as well as the FDA, they hold very different perspectives on the sanctity of life than we do. Their definition of pregnancy is different than what we would put as a definition of pregnancy. And so when they put information together for patients to use, that information in many cases will not match the sanctity of life perspective that we're taking or that that patient is taking. But without realizing that patient may be drawn into believing that she or he, along with her, her spouse, may be using products that they deem to be safe and unknowingly are using them in a way that, if they had known otherwise, would have been essentially abort at.
Finally, as we conclude this conversation, how should Christians who are concerned about bioethics respond to this latest development in our culture, which seems to be minimizing and indeed ignoring many of the grave concerns that the pro-life community has about the sanctity of human life and human dignity generally? How should we respond?
I think several things come to mind, actually. We need to be an informed community, first of all. There was a time in the life of our American culture, for instance, where these were non-issues. We did not have, as far as we understood anyway, drugs that could be used as abortifacients. The very nature of the sanctity of life being a question was not something that crossed our minds. We assumed everybody believed the same way. Well, it's very apparent today, that's simply not the case. And it's not just neighborhood to neighborhood, but as you've already described, it reaches our highest courts, it reaches our highest administrative officials in this country. And so the need to be informed about what life is, when does life begin, what is the process for evaluating whether a drug such as Ella, such as Plan B or anything else, might be something that conflicts with our moral and ethical convictions, and so that we can decide in terms of the manner in which these are going to impact us. I think, though, the key that comes to my mind is how we should respond is with compassion. The community that we are interacting with are not evil communities in and of themselves. They are people who are reading information, oftentimes being misled inadvertently at times. And I think we need to make sure that as we approach our colleagues, as we approach those who believe otherwise than us, that we're treating them as human beings, we're treating them with compassion, we're treating them as Christ would treat them.
You have raised a very important point that I feel very strongly about. Too often, the pro-life side of these controversies has represented itself as angry and sometimes disrespectful of those with whom we disagree. And I really appreciate your emphasis on compassion, respect, and human dignity as we engage in thoughtful, well-informed conversation on these issues. My guest today has been Dr. Jeff Lewis, Assistant Dean of the School of Pharmacy at Cedarville University. Dr. Lewis, thank you so very much for your time with us today.
You're welcome.
That's our program for this month. Our website at cedarethics.org has show notes with helpful links to supplement what we have discussed. Our podcast theme music is from Respighi's Gli Uccelli. Supplemental music comes from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Links to the artists we play are available with our show notes. Perhaps you disagree with some of the things we have discussed today, or perhaps you have additional thoughts. We welcome your comments and suggestions. If you like, you can leave a comment on our website at cedarethics.org. Perhaps you are listening to our program via the internet. However, if you have an MP3 player, be sure to subscribe to get these programs downloaded automatically. It's free, and this way you won't miss a single episode. Be sure to join us next time on the Cedar Ethics Podcast.